You've heard me say for years that NT Factor is the breakthrough supplement that's proven to repair and renew your body's cells. That includes your immune cells, such as your T cells and white blood cells. NT Factor has been shown to contribute to a more robust and effective immune response. So now that we're in cold and flu season, NT Factor is combining with powerful antioxidants, vitamin C and D, to provide you with an immune booster bundle. Vitamin C and D help stimulate the production of white blood cells and activate immune cells, which play a key role in defending against pathogens. Together with NT Factor, they help modulate immune function, reduce inflammation, and promote overall immune health. For a limited time, buy a bottle of NT Factor with D3K2 and get a bottle of C1000 with NT Factor absolutely free. That's a savings of over $26. Just go to ntfactor.com. That's ntfactor.com. Save over $26 on the powerful cocktail of vitamins C and D with NT Factor at ntfactor.com. Welcome back to today's Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman, having a fascinating discussion with my favorite interlocutors. That's a fancy word for people I have conversations with here on the podcast. Neil Levin is the Senior Nutrition Education Manager and a product formulator for Now Foods and Protocol for Life Balance. And a guy who knows, has a very, very wide and deep understanding of nutrition. Neil, I've been following the vitamin K story. And I have to say that, you know, there remains some controversy about, is vitamin K beneficial for preventing cardiovascular disease? I think the story first emerged, I don't know, maybe 5 or 8 years ago, where some studies in Holland revealed that people did particularly well. It was sort of thought to be the Netherlands paradox because they consume a lot of cheese, you know, a lot of saturated fat. The country is known for their Edam cheese and various cheeses. It's not exactly a country that's a low-fat country. And yet they had, like the French paradox, they had a paradoxically low rate of cardiovascular disease. And so just as the French looked at red wine as the secret sauce, and the Italians and Spaniards look at olive oil as the secret sauce, in the Netherlands they said, well, maybe there's something in the cheese that has a protective effect. And then they looked at vitamin K, not just any old vitamin K, but a subtype of vitamin K, which you'll explain. That seemed to have a protective effect against atherosclerosis, with the added dividend that it seemed to enhance bone. So let's talk about vitamin K, the vitamin K story.
Right. Well, vitamin K is actually named vitamin K from the German word for coagulation that starts with a K, not a C.
Coagulation.
Yes. So that's that was discovered. It's a fat-soluble nutrient. And the form that's approved as a essential nutrient in the United States is vitamin K1. So vitamin K comes in.
By the way, do they not give vitamin K injections to babies when they're born?
This is they often do give a single dose to help with coagulation.
So to prevent hemorrhage, you know.
Right.
So it's that important.
Yep. And so there's two, what they're called, vitamers of vitamin K, vitamin K1 and vitamin K2. And vitamin K1 is the main form in the diet. It's about 90% of the vitamin K in the diet. It's the one most closely responsible for clotting. For people who are still taking a blood thinner anticoagulant, Coumadin, that acts on vitamin K. So it's advised, if you're on that medication, my mother was years ago, that you not vary your vitamin K levels a lot from day to day, and you figure out the right dose of the medication.
It's not
based
it's
on
not,
a steady okay. state.
Right. It's not avoid the vitamin K, because this is something that a battle that I've been fighting throughout my career, is that they made lists of vitamin K containing foods, some of which are very beneficial. Tea, for example, green leafy vegetables. And they said, don't ever consume those if you're on Coumadin. Well, no, if you don't consume them, you will get an essential vitamin. But as you say, don't have wild fluctuations, because that'll cause your Coumadin level, your bleeding times that are influenced by Coumadin to bounce around.
And I think the difference between myself and many of these physicians that I've run into, like you have, who have no clue about whether they should take vitamin K or not, is that, I'm reading that, don't eat a giant salad one day and nothing the next day. And when you do that, since you have a drug in this specific case that is working against vitamin K, if you don't have vitamin K, you're going to overdose on the drug in essence for that day. Mm-hmm. So you actually need the minimum amount, but most physicians have no clue about this.
Yeah.
So it's very strange.
Can we dispel another misconception, though, which is
yeah.
A lot of doctors are aghast that I'm recommending that their patients take vitamin K, because they say, oh my goodness, you'll get a blood clot. It's going to cause coagulation. But explain why it's kind of a one-way street. Absence of vitamin K means you're going to have bleeding like a hemophiliac, but you can't OD and cause a blood clot with vitamin K unless you're on Coumadin. That's the one instance where that becomes problematic.
Right. So doctors who just are following orthodoxy and not actually reading studies and looking into the details have no idea that this is a balanced thing. You absolutely need an essential nutrient, and you need normal clotting, even if you're on the medication. You just need to avoid excess clotting because you don't want clots to form and reach the heart. I mean, I'm on another drug, Xarelto, to mm-hmm. prevent clotting because right. I've had arrhythmia for the last 20 years.
Okay.
So it's a way, if I do form a clot, I won't form a clot if I have arrhythmia.
But Xarelto's not vitamin K dependent in any way, shape, or form.
Right. And I don't have to worry about what I eat. So, I like that as an alternative.
Mm-hmm.
So vitamin K1 has that role in the body. It's an essential nutrient. Vitamin K2 is found primarily in fermented foods like cheese, sauerkraut, kimchi, those kind of things. And it's about 10% of dietary vitamin K in the West here. It is not considered an essential nutrient. If you look at modern, at last two or three years, the FDA has actually taken it away. We used to have like a multivitamin that has vitamin K1 and K2 and added together 45 micrograms of K2 and 35 micrograms of K1, 80 micrograms of vitamin K total, which is the old RDA.
Mm-hmm.
When they changed the RDA, they took vitamin K2 away and say, oh, we don't really need this one.
Right.
So now on the label, that same multivitamin is going to have K1 at the top with the things that all have daily values are essential. And in the other ingredients down below, they've moved the vitamin K2 down there.
Well, it's become kind of the orphan child that's been relegated to non-essentiality, but it does play an important role, does it not?
It does. I take a lot of vitamin K2. And I take a specific form called MK7.
Okay, so it's not like Chinese boxes. It's like, okay, there's K, there's K1, K2, and then within K2, there's subtypes.
Right. And the main kind you get in the diet is MK4, which is a specific type of compound. And that's mostly what you're getting from the diet. In that 10% of the diet that's dietary vitamin K is vitamin K2. The unusual form is called MK7, which was found in a cultured soybean product called natto from mm-hmm. Japan. And natto is both the source of nattokinase, an anti-clotting enzyme,
mm-hmm.
and it has this vitamin K2, which is related to clotting, but not as strongly as K1.
Mm-hmm.
So that has become very popular, primarily because it is absorbed many, many times better than MK4. It has very poor absorption. And the half-life is dramatically higher as well.
MK7.
MK7.
Mm-hmm.
And MK7 works by slowly converting it to MK4 in the body.
Okay.
So you're still getting that MK4, but it's a super absorbed, long-lasting, time-release version. that works so much better. You get so much more bang for the buck. And if you look at a label and it just says K2, it's going to be MK4. That's the generic standard form.
Okay.
MK7 is a very specialty form. Mm-hmm. And nowadays, with people afraid of soybeans or of, a relative handful of people allergic to soybeans, even if they're non-GMO and fermented, we have the MK7 that's fermented on chickpeas. So they're soy-free, but it's using the same culture.
Wow. You really went out of your way to appease the soy phobiacs.
Yes.
Right?
Yep. And, it's a good way to get it. What it does is it helps with a couple of things. If you take vitamin D, it helps you absorb calcium, but it doesn't move calcium out of the arteries.
Okay.
Vitamin K2 does that.
Uh-huh.
And vitamin D also activates a substance called osteocalcin that's responsible for a lot of the activities. Vitamin D is really a precursor of active forms in the body. Mm-hmm. And osteocalcin is one of the main ones. And vitamin K also, once you make osteocalcin from vitamin D, it's activated by vitamin K2.
Oh.
And the combination lets you scavenge the calcium out of the arteries and move it into the bones or tissues or whatever, where they belong. You need that 1-2 punch. If you're just taking a lot of vitamin D, you're accumulating calcium and it doesn't really have a place to go.
Right.
And that's why you start getting the stiffening in the arteries and stuff. You've not only got collagen damage that is being patched with oxidized cholesterol, but then after a while, that's starting to attract the calcium and stiffen the arteries even more, which raises blood pressure. Remember, every time the heart beats, the artery near the heart has to expand to let that pulse of blood through. And if it gets stiff and can't expand or narrowed with plaque and calcium and stiff, the blood pressure goes sky high. You cannot control it. Eventually, that sticky stuff can attract clots, and you know what happens then.
Indeed. You know, I've always thought that it was really a disservice to tell people, you know, in the old days, we had no alternatives like the one you're taking, Eliquis. People had to take Coumadin if they wanted to be on a blood thinner. And these were the very self-same people who probably were older, had cardiovascular risk, and could have benefited from vitamin K, but they were told, in no uncertain terms, no vitamin K for you. And they were denied the opportunity to get the protection that vitamin K might have afforded them in, as you say, regular, moderate amounts consistently.
Yeah. What's interesting is I have an actual backstory with the development of Coumadin, because I used to work with a guy, Dr. Bill Reason, who was as a grad student at University of Wisconsin-Madison, was involved in Defense Department research on Coumadin as a potential chemical weapon type thing.
It originally derived from warfarin, which is a rat poison.
Right. So they were actually looking at that and how to use it, if it was usable in that regard. So I actually have a direct connection to that. Weird story.
Right. Well, maybe the CIA was going to use it for some of their assassination attempts on enemy agents.
Put it in Castro's cigar or something.
Put it in Castro, exactly. And, blood would come out of his, all of his orifices. All right, good stuff. So you also, perhaps you've been involved in formulating a kind of a combo product for cardiovascular protection. Can you tell us about that by Protocol for Life Balance?
Yeah, I mean, that's an interesting product we have. It's called Clinical Cardio 6. And I actually take all of these things separately in higher doses. The advantage with this is it's one bottle.
Okay.
And you're getting a moderate amount you could actually take more of if you want to. So it's got vitamin D.
You're an aficionado and a zealot, and you work for a company which gives you, deep discounts on product. So you don't mind taking, a bunch of different things, and you have a good swallowing reflex. But for people, for convenience, we can combine these ingredients.
Right. So, for example, it's got vitamin D, and in one capsule, it's got 1,000 IU, which is 25 micrograms.
Mm-hmm.
I take 5,000 a day, you know, just to give you a comparison.
Yep.
It has L-carnitine, the Carnipure, which is the trademark material from Lonza, a Swiss company. And their claim to fame is that it has no synthetic D-carnitine in there, because carnitine is synthesized. It's either synthesized in muscle, because like carnivore carnitine
mm-hmm.
is found primarily in meat.
Right.
So for vegetarians, we're making it, really the limiting factor is the amino acid L-lysine.
Lysine, yeah. Lysine is part of the pathway.
One of the essential amino acids. Mm-hmm. So I take lysine and I take carnitine because I'm trying to get more of those. And being on a heavy grain diet, again, that food combining we talked about in part one, grains are low in lysine.
Okay.
So, you know, if I'm eating a lot of grains on the road or stuff, you know, I take some lysine morning and in the evening, it helps to balance my amino acids.
Mm-hmm.
So the carnitine is 250 milligram. You know, people are taking a gram or 3 grams a day for really therapeutic use. But, you know, carnitine is used to shuttle fatty acids through the mitochondria membrane. The mitochondria are these little, they're called organelles. They're actually believed to be separate organisms that got absorbed into human cells long, long, long time ago. The mitochondria is what produces energy in the cell. So having the carnitine allows you to feed these energy factories in the cells. There's a lot more mitochondria in muscle cells than most other cells, and there tends to be a bunch in the brain as well. So these are the areas, of course, that are using so much energy that we talked about.
And of course, the myocytes, the heart muscle, because they're the hardest working muscles in the body. They never stop.
Correct. We have hawthorn extract. And what's interesting about this is this is not standard hawthorn berries. This is hawthorn leaf and flower extract. The German Commission e-monographs that have a lot of information about botanicals and their therapeutic uses actually removed the monograph for hawthorn berry and replaced it with hawthorn leaf and flower extract because that's what helps the heart pump harder and faster and more efficiently, and helps regulate blood pressure to some extent. So we actually use it in a blood pressure formula as well for that reason. Rapeseed extracts. This is, again, a very unusual one. This is not generic. This is the mega natural BP material, which is made from non-fermented rapeseeds from California. And they mill it very fine. So they end up with a better solubility without going to nanotechnology or anything like that. Mm-hmm. Simple milling and particle size is what does it. Nanotechnology means actually structuring things in a different way rather than just reducing particle size with what's naturally possible. And all the grapeseed extracts help with blood pressure and epithelial health. And it's actually considered a good antioxidant or free radical scavenger. But the solubility is not so great. And so with this, you could get more bang for the buck at a lower dose, lower amount you take, and you're getting a stronger effect.
Is it akin in some ways to pycnogenol? For some reason, I associate the two.
Yes, they're both polyphenols. And okay. I actually take pycnogenol, the pine bark extract, in the morning.
Mm-hmm.
And I take the grapeseed extract at night.
Mm-hmm.
And I do the same thing. I take a multivitamin with vitamin D in the morning and my extra vitamin D at night. Or there's alpha-lipoic acid in my multi, and I'll take extra alpha-lipoic acid at night. I'm always watching to not double up at the same time of day or meal, but to separate them, you know, get something that's either similar or the same thing that's in my other one.
Mm-hmm.
You know, separate it during the day and get it more spread out.
So the mega natural grapeseed extract is essentially for circulation, promoting circulation, endothelial.
Right. It actually increases the force of the heart pump.
Oh, okay.
So when the heart pumps, it's more effective at expelling the blood into the arteries. Hopefully the arteries can expand and let that in with every heartbeat and is flexible enough because you're having enough antioxidants to support the collagen where it doesn't break down.
So ejection fraction is, you know, a consideration as people get older or they have heart problems or congestive heart failure, the ejection fraction goes down. And so maintaining that improves general energy and output.
Right.
Okay.
So, I mean, it's good for the heart, but it helps with blood pressure because it's pushing that through the cardiovascular system quickly.
Okay. I've lost count. There's six ingredients. What else?
Yeah. Besides that, we have coenzyme Q10, which we discussed earlier in part one. 50 milligrams, you know, again, it's not a huge dose. I'm taking 200 milligrams twice a day. But if you just want to get it all in one bottle and you want it, you could take more than one capsule, obviously. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. This is one capsule version. And it's got 90 micrograms of MK7 form of vitamin K2.
Which is a good amount, yeah.
Yeah, it's a good amount. So you're, you know, there's no RDA or daily value on any of these except vitamin D. But, you know, if I were taking this myself, I would probably do maybe two with each meal or something, you know, to get the dosing I'm taking.
Okay.
And I'd only buy one bottle.
Right.
So, you know, that's another way to go.
Right. Okay. So also, I guess there was another one that we wanted to consider among your product lineups. Do you have the Mega Natural rapeseed extract as a separate offering?
We have it. It's not standalone. We fill the capsule with the Mega Natural BP and the hawthorn together.
Okay.
The hawthorn leaf and flower extract. So that's really a blood pressure formula specifically.
Okay. So to find out about these products and for all the products at PFLB, for more information and to order, just go to drhoffman.com/protocol for life balance. That's drhoffman.com/protocol for life balance. And now for some bonus questions. Okay. Cause while I have you, I want to get your opinion on some of these things. Big controversy about seed oils. Okay. And it's even, entered the, you know, the blogosphere and social media. I believe that RFK Jr. has weighed in against the prevalence of seed oils, which are thought to imbalance our omega-6-to-3 ratio. We recently had Kate Shanahan on, who's really inveighed against the harms caused by refined seed oils, the safflower oils, the soybean oil, the cottonseed oil, even the canola oil that introduces a fair amount of omega-6s into our cell membranes, and they say gums up the works, and it really should be all about the omega-3s. They're good. The omega-6s are bad. You as a vegetarian, by definition, you probably consume a fair amount of omega-6s. What's your opinion about this bitter controversy that's being played out in, you know, on X and, you know, in the social media?
Well, there's multiple factors going on here. One is some of these are genetically engineered crops, cottonseed oil, soybean oil, you know, things like that, canola oil. Now, canola oil in cardiovascular health is actually considered healthier than olive oil. It has more monounsaturates. So when it's stacked up and you're measuring cholesterol effects from eating the oil, you're finding stronger evidence that canola oil is more heart healthy than olive oil.
Mm-hmm.
Now, olive oil has other, you know, antioxidant type compounds in there, you know, polyphenols and things like that. Also, you have the canola oil being GMO, which of course is a negative. But it's not all GMO. It was conventionally bred in the 1960s.
Mm-hmm.
So from rapeseed oil to make something that's a little better for you.
Yeah, I think they now have what's called high oleic canola oils, which amps up the mono fraction relatively. Yeah.
Right. So actually, it's a very healthy oil, assuming it's non-GMO and doesn't have, you know, Roundup in there, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
But it's the ratio that really is important. Omega 3 and omega 6 compete for an enzyme called delta 6 desaturase, which is a magnesium dependent enzyme. And as we mentioned in the first part of the show,
B6 and zinc as well, I think also.
Yeah, right? But 80% of men are not expected to get enough magnesium in their diet without supplementation.
Mm-hmm.
If you don't have enough magnesium, you're not going to convert the ALA, the omega-3, in plant foods like flax, walnuts, hemp, etc., into EPA, which mm-hmm. is the form you get in fish oil mm-hmm. or krill oil. Or algae in some cases. So being able to make that conversion inefficiently is a problem. Now, both omega-3 and omega-6 are precursors of what are called prostaglandins.
Mm-hmm.
And these are chemical control agents that control inflammatory processes. In general, this is really an overgeneralization, but in general, omega-6 fats tend to make the inflammatory compounds
the
body needs.
So they say.
That the body needs.
Mm-hmm.
And you need that as a demolition tool and as an immune system weapon.
Mm-hmm.
You need this oxidation and inflammation going
mm-hmm.
on. On the other hand, you need to control it.
Yeah.
You know, let's say you're using dynamite to excavate and build a bridge. It's a controlled explosion. You know, you're taking precautions.
Right.
So the precautions are
You don't want an uncontrolled chain reaction like a Chernobyl meltdown.
Right.
You want the control rods to stay in that reactor.
Right. And omega-3 is providing that control.
Okay.
And it's producing the anti-inflammatory prostaglandins.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a balance. Mm-hmm. It's estimated that the ideal ratio is somewhere between 3-1 omega-6 to omega-3 to 5-1 omega-6 to omega-3.
Mm-hmm.
And some people advocate 1-1.
Mm-hmm.
And that might be advised if you have inflammatory diseases
right.
things like that, where you're trying to really tone down the inflammation
right.
with these control systems. But the American diet is estimated to be 16-1 or 18-1.
Yeah.
And it's the imbalance that's the problem. We're eating so much of the processed foods that are fried that becomes a problem. So it's not the fat itself necessarily, it's the amount of fat and the fact that it's so processed.
Processed and damaged perhaps by, you know, repeated high temperature cooking. You know, they don't throw out the oil after every batch of
right.
french fries, you know, it wouldn't be uneconomical.
Yep. So, I mean, really the science is pretty clear. Omega-3 is what most people are deficient in. There are some forms of omega-6 that are healthy and non-inflammatory, like GLA,
yes.
that you get in borage oil, evening primrose oil.
Yes.
You know, and a lot of people with skin problems would benefit by taking those forms, of, especially GLA,
yep.
form of omega-6. And women with period and cycle issues often will benefit by doing the evening primrose oil.
Which is a prostaglandin-mediated problem. The
yeah.
pain and inflammation in the uterus. The uterus is very rich in prostaglandins. And so you want to get that balance of the eicosanoids, which are the precursors, right. But it's not as, I don't think it's as simplistic as some people say. I don't think that it is, you know, horrible to eat, you know, seeds and foods that are natural sources of omega, unrefined sources of omega-6.
Right. It's the uncontrolled consumption of omega-6, the very limited consumption of omega-3, and the fact that so much of the omega-6 is heavily processed
right.
and grown with chemicals
right.
that really is the problem.
Oh, so I just read a study. And in fact, I commented on that study for Natural Medicine Journal, because they said, you know, what do you think of the study? And the study showed that consumption of omega-3s was protective against cancer. But surprisingly, it showed that consumption of omega-6s was also protective against cancer. That was the surprise. But what they did show is, as you point out, is that an adverse ratio of too many omega-6s to 3s was associated with a higher risk of cancer. So it's the ratio right. that is the problem. But they kind of exonerated the consumption of these healthy fats. And the take-home message was that an ultra-low-fat diet may not be so beneficial for cancer.
Right. And, you know, when you're looking at traditional diets, they're not going to be that high in omega-6. I mean, when you're looking at grazing animals, they have a lot more omega-3 in their milk and meat than animals that are fed milk and soybeans that don't have a lot of omega-3 in those sources. They're getting it from their diet. And if the diet doesn't contain it, they're not going to have it. It's just that the same with chickens and eggs. If they're out there eating bugs and weeds that we would consider weeds, they're going to have a lot more omega-3 in their eggs, for example, or meat.
Yes.
Than
especially things like purslane, for example. Purslane is a weed, you know, that I find on my driveway sometimes, and I go, well, great, you know, let me wash it off and put it in my salad. You know, hopefully no dogs came along, you know, to empty their bladders on it. But okay, so, you know, I think we've cleared that up. Here's an extra credit question, and I really want your opinion on this, because I get asked this all the time, and I'm sure you do too. Because so the industry trend these days is liposomal, everything liposomal, liposomal this, liposomal that. And so talk to us about the advantages of liposomal encapsulation of certain products. It's a microencapsulation that's supposed to make things more bioavailable. But where's the reality here? Where's the hype? And is it just a gimmick to offer people a more expensive version of something that could be quite well absorbed in its original form?
Well, I think it varies with each substance that we're talking about.
Okay.
Liposome is basically making a sphere, and that's usually done using after you digest your food and your fats are digested into fatty acids, the body kind of assembles them into a sphere using lipase, a pancreatic enzyme. And these fat cells have kind of a head and a tail, and one side's more fat soluble and one side's a little more water soluble. So by assembling them in a sphere with the water soluble side out.
Are these called chylomicrons? Is my recollection correct?
Not sure about that.
Okay, because that's for absorption of fat anyway.
Right. Yeah. And so now you have a way to absorb it better.
Okay.
And of course the bile comes down and finds this thing and brings it back to the liver. So the issue is, what are they using it for? And is it really increasing the solubility? And even more importantly than solubility, the efficacy.
Mm-hmm.
Can you take less and get more?
Mm-hmm.
Or benefit? Because I've seen, like for curcumin, the turmeric extract, you could increase the solubility and bioavailability dramatically without necessarily affecting inflammatory markers, which is the whole reason why people take curcumin.
That's the use case, I think, for
Right. I want to see efficacy and safety. I'm not impressed by solubility or bioavailability without seeing what it ends up doing.
So I got a question from a caller about liposomal vitamin D. And my answer was, I'm not sure that is not just an excuse to make a more expensive, fancy version of vitamin D, which could be a fairly generic, commoditized nutrient that's fairly inexpensive. And if you want to boost your vitamin D levels and you can't do it with a small amount, take a little more. You know, you don't need to use a liposomal vitamin D to do that.
Well, I would suspect its normal absorption is liposomal. So what you're doing is not allowing the digestive system to do that. You're taking a pre-digested form that's already like that.
Oh, I see. Okay.
So if you have pancreatic insufficiency or something,
maybe
it's going to be very good.
Yes.
But for a normal person, that's how you're typically going to absorb your vitamin D.
I see.
Making your own liposomes. You're just buying them pre-sub.
I see. And then
the weird issue is when you start taking these water-soluble things.
Yes, like vitamin C. Because, I mean, it's thought that it conducts the vitamin C through the cell membrane, blah, 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 because vitamin C is a a water soluble, it's a polar compound. And so it is repelled by the cell membrane. And by putting it in a liposome, there's better uptake. That's sort of the argument, right?
Yeah, but vitamin C absorbs through the entire digestive tract.
Yeah, that's what I
think. And it doesn't have a targeted area like a certain place in the small intestine.
Okay.
As many nutrients do. And when you have a liposome, it only will go in the small intestine because you've made it into a form that has to transport there and isn't going to go through the colon or something and still be absorbed.
Right.
So you're kind of limiting where it and how fast it could be absorbed.
Oh.
But maybe you're enhancing the absorption. So I've seen studies. One study I saw on the liposomal C was they gave 5 grams of that and 5 grams of normal ascorbic acid.
Mm-hmm.
And they really had no difference in inflammatory markers.
Uh-oh.
Now, 5 grams is a pretty good dose, though.
Yes.
But I'm wondering if they gave too much to show a big difference.
Hmm.
They did show some indication that it absorbed better or might have gone in into cells better. But you know, when you're looking at efficacy in terms of inflammatory markers or some specific result, There was no efficacy difference. There was an absorption difference.
Uh-huh.
So it makes me wonder, you know, vitamin C is kind of tricky because it's got a half-life in circulation and plasma at about 30 minutes.
The body wants to excrete it very rapidly through the kidneys.
Well, we have to recycle it. It keeps being oxidized.
Okay.
Because it's an antioxidant. It's an electron donor.
Mm-hmm.
So it stops these electrical chain reactions going through these oxidative things, and it stops them by donating electrons. It's like putting a stopper in it,
mm-hmm.
that reaction. And at that point, you have to recycle it or it starts metabolizing into things you can't use.
Mm-hmm.
So because we can't generate our own vitamin C in our livers like almost every mammal can, we have to have these variety of antioxidants that will recycle the vitamin C.
Mm-hmm.
So absorption alone is only part of the picture to me.
Mm-hmm.
You need the other things. I always tell people, you know, don't take 5 or 10 grams of vitamin C. If you could take a gram of vitamin C and you take rapeseed extract,
mm-hmm.
and you could take the pine bark extract and the alpha lipoic acid and all the polyphenols, those things are going to assure that you have vitamin C. If you take a lot of vitamin C, it's going to start degrading fast. And, you know, it's kind of a hassle to take a lot of vitamin C, too.
Right.
I'd rather go broad.
Have GI side effects and so on. Yeah. Right.
Yeah. I want to go broad on the antioxidant variety rather than deep on a single one.
Yeah. Okay. So, yeah, I think we're on the same wavelength when it comes to the liposomal. I think it's a useful technology for delivering something that might be limited in its bioavailability, especially things like curcumin, which is notoriously poorly absorbed. And the liposomal forms may, because it's a large molecule, it can conduct it better through the digestive system.
The phytosome, like the Mariva material, which has a lot of good studies on joint and muscle health.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a phytosome using phosphatidylcholine, using a specific molecule to make the liposome.
And from what I understand, it's not so simple as like there's one way to make liposomes. There's many different ways to microencapsulate, and you got to figure out the right way, and it differs from substance to substance. And actually, they do this with medications, and it's tricky because there are certain medications that are broken down before they're absorbed, and they really have looked at liposomal technology for even cancer drugs, and they found a few that work, but it's actually very, very challenging to get the right encapsulation. So I mean, it's a buzzword these days, and I think it connotes to the consumer added value that somehow this is an enhanced version of a traditional nutrient. And we have to look at the individual cases.
Yeah, I mean, it depends on the substance and it depends on how good the digestive is in the person. You know, if their pancreas is simply not producing enzymes, that's an issue.
Yeah.
But, you know, that's a limited selection. That's not the general public.
Exactly. People with severe fat malabsorption,
right.
That kind of syndrome. All right, great. Well, I always learn in our conversation. I could, you know, I could talk to you for hours, but we'll save that for, you know, a dinner sometime. I'll pick your brains, but I enjoy picking your brains on behalf of my listeners. So thanks very much for joining us. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and thank you, Neil, and this is the Intelligent Medicine Podcast.
I want to thank you for listening to the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. Follow us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, or your favorite podcast app, and get new episodes automatically downloaded every weekday. And please give us a rating and review. It truly helps new people discover Intelligent Medicine. The Intelligent Medicine Podcast is for general informational purposes only and does not constitute the practice of medicine, nursing, or other professional healthcare services, including the giving of medical advice, and no doctor-patient relationship is formed. The use of information on this podcast or materials linked from this podcast is at the user's own risk. The content of this podcast is not intended to be a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Users should not disregard or delay in obtaining medical advice for any medical condition they may have, and should seek the assistance of their healthcare professionals for any such conditions. Finally, please visit drhoffman.com and discover everything Intelligent Medicine has to offer, including frequently updated, unbiased health news, and fully vetted product and supplement recommendations. You know how important it is to ensure that your supplements are genuine, safe, and effective. That's why I partnered with Fullscript, an online dispensing platform that only offers curated professional-grade brands I know and trust, the very same supplements that I prescribe to my patients and take myself. Never counterfeit or expired, always stored and shipped correctly. Just go to drhoffmanstore.com to start your free Fullscript account. Buying through Fullscript offers fast shipping, optional refill reminders, a mobile-friendly site. It's safe, secure, and HIPAA compliant and offers world-class support. Fullscript also gives you access to my custom targeted supplement protocols that combine the products that I recommend to address specific needs, heart health, immune support, and much more. Just go to drhoffmanstore.com to sign up for your free Fullscript account. You'll get access to the supplements and features you need to help you achieve your wellness goals. That's drhoffmanstore.com. drhoffmanstore.com.